For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome. I'm very happy this evening to have Laurel Ross, who's our assistant director and board member at Ancient Dragon Zengate, giving the talk tonight. Thank you, Laurel.
You're welcome. good evening, everyone. This might be a little bit of an oddball talk. So I've had this really tough last 6 months. I retired in December, and I sort of, I think what I thought is that my life would be like I would be on vacation for the rest of my life, but it hasn't really worked out that way at all. And the universe has handed me some tough things to deal with. My brother got really sick, and daughter had a career crisis, and my car got burglarized, and they took my binoculars, which I really needed for the spring bird migration. And just recently, the worst thing happened, which is that a dear friend and my Tai Chi teacher, who I hiked in the Appalachian Trail with on March 30th, died on June 2nd. So that was shocking and hard. And so when I was thinking about what to talk about tonight, I was telling my friend, well, you know, I could talk about death, I could talk about loss, I could talk about illness. And she said, oh, Zen is so gloomy. So I decided that, and I told Taigen, and he said that was okay, that this would be a funny Dharma talk, the best more I can
than,
make it.
More than okay, really good.
Really good. So I'm going to do my best. So at the end, during the discussion, if you have any, you know, Zen jokes to share, be thinking them up, and we can do that doing discussion. So I do want to distinguish between humor and jokes, though. So an example of a Zen joke is, why did the Buddhist coroner get fired? Because he'd always record the cause of death as birth. So that's a joke. But humor is not quite the same as jokes. And I have these four books, and obviously I don't have that much time, but these are the four funniest Zen books I've ever read. And they're not really jokes. They're really... I think of humor as telling the truth in a way that really delights us, so that we smile and we laugh. And so I'm going to read from some of these, and I hope you'll laugh. So I did want to quote George Carlin Roshi, who in his memoir talked about humor in a way that I really, really like. He says, when you're in front of an audience and you make them laugh at a new idea, you're guiding the whole being for the moment. No one is ever more himself or herself than when they really laugh. Their defenses are down. It's very Zen-like, that moment. They're completely open, completely themselves when that message hits the brain and the laugh begins. And that's when new ideas can be implanted. If a new idea slips in at that moment, it has a chance to grow. So anyway, so these are the four funniest Zen books I know. I'll start with David Chadwick's book called Thank You and Okay, An American Zen Failure in Japan. Well, let me just go through them all, and then I'll come back to this one. Then there's Susan Moon's book, The Life and Letters of Tofu Roshi. She is the co-author of a book that we had the other co-editor, I should say, of the book, The Hidden Lamp, with Florence Kaplow, who is here. But this is one of her earlier books, The Life and Letters of Tofu Roshi. Jack Kerouac's Dharma Bums, I love, and it's hilarious. And then Ambivalent Zen by Lauren Schoenberg. So that's my bibliography. I have Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind here just to remind myself to say that I think one reason I love these books is they are people talking about Zen. Imperfect people, just like me and you, talking about Zen, people from our culture and sort of their struggles with it, and I relate to it very directly sometimes. And so in the laughing is me learning a little bit about my own Zen practice from hearing their crazy struggles with their Zen practice. And I love Suzuki Roshi's talk about, you know, the four horses, the one that's so perfect and just flies at top speed with no encouragement from the rider, and then the second most who just needs the shadow of the whip, and then the third that actually needs to get struck, and then the fourth and worst horse that just needs really to get the whip down to the marrow before it will actually run. And Suzuki Roshi says, you know, people want to identify with that first horse, the really great one, but he thinks it's the worst horse that Buddha would have had the most sympathy for, and that a lot of times it's the people that struggle the hardest that get the most out of it. So a lot of these people did a lot of struggling. So anyway, so David Chadwick, he's the biographer of Suzuki Roshi, and if you haven't read Crooked Cucumber, it's the book I recommend to people who aren't Buddhist who want to know about Zen. I just think it's wonderful. But this is his story of when he spent 3.5 years in Japan. He was ordained by Suzuki and spent a lot of time at San Francisco Zen Center. And then after, I don't know, 10 or more years there, he spent some time in Japan with Katagiri Roshi. And this book he wrote based on letters that he had written while he was there. And so it's a really engaging style. And I have this brand new book because I keep buying it and giving it to people and not getting it back. So it looks like I haven't read it, but I've actually read it a few times. So just to give you a sense of his style, so this is the page before the preface. He says, "Once, when I was driving Suzuki Roshi to Zen Center from Tassajara, after we'd stopped at the original Thunderbird bookstore in Carmel Valley, and he'd had 3 cups of coffee, and I too, we got back into the car, and I was all jacked up and driving down the road, and I said, 'Suzuki Roshi, may I ask you a question?' And he said, 'Yes.' And I proceeded to beg him to tell me what it is that I should do to understand reality, to get enlightened. I told him I was totally dedicated to the way, and that whatever he told me I would do, no matter what it was, I went on and on, making sure he was thoroughly aware of my sincerity and devotion. I turned to him for an answer. He was sound asleep." So, you know, it's sort of very entertaining, but it also sort of tells you, if you get all puffed up about your sincerity, you look pretty ridiculous. It also sort of tells you that Suzuki Roshi was a pretty skillful teacher. So I'm going to read you just a few excerpts from his time in Japan, and I think they're pretty self-explanatory. He changed everyone's name except the name of the monastery he was at, except for Katagiri's and himself. There's a character in here named Norman who I swear I'm madly in love with, but apparently he's a composite character, but he's very, very fun, and I love Norman. But
no, he's not. I know who that is. It's
okay.
It's not Norman Fisher.
I'm sure it's not Norman Fisher.
I know all the people in this and the places in this.
Anyway, okay. Well, that'll be for another talk. Maybe that'll be for the discussion. Okay, so the single item on the altar this expert excerpt explains the title. It's an odd title. Thank you and okay. "The single item on the altar that I can see most clearly in my mind's eye as I write is the matchbook. It's no ordinary matchbook. The matches are regular old strike-anywhere wood matches, but the container is striking. It's an A-frame box about 6 inches high. The matches are in a drawer on the bottom of the A with a rough striking zone on the front of the drawer. On each side of this matchbox is a photo of a middle-aged Japanese man giving the thumbs up sign. He's winking, sticking his chin out and tightening his lips in a beaming smile, all in a way that immediately conveys a gung-ho, agreeable attitude. In big, bold letters across the side of the box are written the words, "Thank you and okay." For a time, every altar in the temple had one of these boxes on it. Everywhere I looked, that man was giving the thumbs up sign and saying, "Thank you and okay." When we first saw one of those matchboxes, Norman and I had a long laughing spell. We didn't know what the purpose was, but it was surely some sort of advertisement. As an isolated event, it was goofy and humorous, but then we saw them everywhere, and we're at a loss to understand what on earth they were doing there. The Japanese monks, unlike Norman and me, didn't seem to notice them at all. One day after work, Norman and I were just outside our room talking. Maku was nearby getting the altar ready for evening service. Shuko came in with some flowers and Norman saw his chance. He walked over to the altar, held up one of the aforementioned boxes and asked Shuko, "Where did this come from?" "What?" said Shuko. "This," he said, pushing it closer to Shuko's face. "From Agaki-san. He gave us a case of them. Agaki-san owns a liquor store and was one of the best friends of the temple." Norman looked concerned. "He gave us a case? What for?" "To light things. We don't have electricity, or we need a lot of matches," Shuko said. "Thanks for the information," Norman said sarcastically. "What's wrong with the plain brown matchboxes we've been using?" "We can use them too," Shuko answered. "You're not really going to leave these up on the altars, are you?" Norman continued. "Yes," said Shuko, "of course." "They look stupid, Shuko." Shuko spoke in a monotone. "You know, our way is not to complain so much." "And who is this we who don't complain?" said Norman, perturbed. "Do you mean we, Japanese?" "No," said Shuko. "Then just who do you mean?" "That's the tradition of Buddhism," Shuko answered. "Listen, I'm 48 years old and been studying with Katagiri Roshi for 12 years. Don't talk to me like I'm a child." "Why don't you like them?" Shuko answered with a question. "Shuko, come on, they don't fit. Look around. Everything is hundreds of years old. These matches stand out. Like, well, there's nothing as absurd as they are to even compare them with." Norman glared at him. "This was a gift to the temple," said Shuko. "Good. I'm going to give the temple a neon sign that says, Buddha saves." "It's not the same," said Shuko. Mako and I looked at each other, opening our eyes wide and making a silly what's going to happen look. "Shuko, you're always saying you want to follow Dogen's original way of 800 years ago, right? Ha, ha, ha. Thank you and okay." "Some things would be too impractical," said Shuko. "Oh, now we're getting practical. Then why don't we run some electricity in here?" "All temples use matches," Shuko pointed out. "It's not the matches, it's the design," Norman said, exasperated. "What's wrong with the design? Look at these. See this guy? Thank you and okay? What's wrong with that?" "We don't say that," said Norman. "Japanese people don't read the words." "I do. David does," said Norman. "And not everyone is Japanese. Isn't this an international temple?" "You shouldn't discriminate so much," Shuko came back, using an old standby as an admonition. Norman was incensed, and smoke was rising in circles. "What do you mean I shouldn't discriminate? Do you think you never discriminate? We could use them in the kitchen, but your discriminating consciousness decided to put them on the altars next to 500-year-old scrolls." "Why do I waste my time?" Norman threw up his hands. So that gives you a little bit of a flavor of how how they got along in their intercultural communication. So I've been having personal trouble with Urayoki, so I thought I'd read a little bit about his his experience with Oriyoku. I don't really have time to read it all. It's absolutely wonderfully hilarious. But here's a little bit of it. Dogen, the founder of Japanese Soto Zen, wrote a treatise on just exactly how to do it, meaning Oriyoku. He left a lot of tracks on how to do this or that just right in the monastic life. How to get up, wash, clean the teeth, dress, walk, study, wear your robes, make meals, greet senior or junior monks, you name it, he told you exactly how to do it. There was a visiting Roshi at Tassajara a long time ago while Suzuki was still alive, who gave two-hour talks every night on all that minutia. Some of us called him Bulldog Roshi. He was the complete Menmitsu no Kafu freak. Did I say that right?
Mm-hmm.
He'd been the Ino at Aheiji for 13 years, which means he was in charge of discipline and ceremony. We all just wanted to sit zazen with a reasonable mix of ceremony, lectures, and work, but this guy OD'd us on Dogen's details till they were running out of our ears. It was like being trapped in the Amy Vanderbilt School of Etiquette by an anal retentive who had a messiah complex, and it caused a great deal of resentment. At Tassajara, when someone got too finicky about following Dogen's way, someone else might roll their eyes and say, nine clay balls. That referred to Dogen's instructions as to how the monks should wipe their asses. Hatagiri said that when he was at Aheiji, he tried to do everything just right and even practiced nine clay balls. He said he was the only one to do it, perhaps for centuries. He never did explain what exactly that practice entails, but he did tell me that the only essential practice of Zen is Zazen, and Dogen said the same thing. So you could pretty much open this book at any page and get a great story. I'm going to read just two more quick ones, partly because I actually learned stuff from this that I didn't really know too much about. And this is his part of his description on Takahatsu, which is the formal begging that the monks do for their food, and it's way more complicated than I understood, and he got thrown into it 4 days after he arrived, so he was a little bit, there's a long explanation of his feelings about it, which we don't have time to read, but I'll read you just two paragraphs. So, Sunday after lunch, Katagiri, Shuko, Norman, Maku, Jaku, Shin, and I gathered on the deck and put on the traditional gear of Takahatsu. It was a sunny day, and we all wore thin black kimono over our kimono. Katagiri pulled the linen mesh kimono up under my waist cord to shorten it a few inches. He said it would make it easier to walk. We put on rough straw sandals that tied around our ankles, secured curious white cotton covers on our forearms and shins, and hung an extra pair of sandals at our sides. Around our necks, we put our raksu, and over them slung black heavy cotton bags holding our begging bowls and wooden-handled bells. Then Katagiri tied a white cloth called a hachimaki around my forehead that would stop the sweat from going into my eyes, he said. I appreciated all the attention he was giving me. I felt like I was being dressed for the prom. Last, we donned straw hats the shape of wide cones. They came down to eye level, as good as sunglasses. Katagiri pointed out to me that they had the name of the temple in large kanji across the front and solemnly admonished me to be on good behavior. I assumed a fiercely serious pose, and he laughed in spite of himself. I looked around at my almsmate, now all bedecked like me. We were dashing. And then as they were going around begging, when the moment was right, Shuko stopped and got out his bowl. And using the thumb and first two fingers of our left hands to form a tripod, we raised our bowls to eye level, and holding the bells down with our right hands, we set out calling, ho, and ringing the bells vigorously. All day long, I thought it was the ho that meant the teaching, Japanese for the Sanskrit word dharma. That evening, Norman told me he'd heard it was actually an abbreviation for hatsu, which means bowl, in this case, the begging bowl. We passed old funky markets and modern convenience stores, traditional shops selling kimonos, sweets, altars, incense, pottery, and scrolls. And into crowded, covered, modern shopping streets lined with boutiques, coffee shops, and drugstores. The people were quiet, but the air was filled with loud, irritating advertisements and overlapping music broadcast through loudspeakers. A whiter shade of pale faded into a pop version of Taco Bell's Canon as we worked our way down the mall. In this commercial maelstrom, one by one, we'd pull out of the group at a door and, standing erect, alone, and hopefully more noble than ridiculous, would each chant the Enmei Juko Kanongyo loudly 3 times. Almost nobody understands this antiquated Buddhist Japanese any more than I understand Chaucer, but they know the name of Kanseon, and when they hear it, that's enough, the Virgin Mary of Buddhism. More often than not, someone would come running out and place a coin or two in the bowl. In that case, the first chant would not be repeated, and there would be a second recitation in which gratitude was expressed and boundless merit promised. Then that monk would bow, empty the money from the bowl into the black bag around his neck, turn and walk toward the direction of the others, calling, "Ho!" With all of us outfitted thus and going ho in those shopping areas, I felt like we were related in a peculiar way to the Santas collecting money for charity on the street corners downtown in December in the States. So anyway, that's David Chadwick, just a delightful guy. When he was here a couple years ago, he didn't have a car, and I got to drive him a few places, like down to Hyde Park and back. And he's exactly like that in person. So if you ever have an opportunity to hear him. So the second book, I got time. So the second book is The Life and Letters of Tofu Roshi. You probably guess it's imaginary Roshi. So Susan Moon, she writes humor. She has a current book on aging called This Is Getting Old, which I haven't read, but it got great reviews. And the conceit of this one is that the author is the secretary of this Roshi, and people will write him letters asking him for advice, and then she transcribes the letters, and so this is a record of advice that Tofu Roshi is giving to people that are asking for his advice. Where to start? Okay. Dear Tofu Roshi, our meditation center is being torn apart by acrimonious debate about the proper ritual to follow for leaving the meditation hall. Some say those nearest the door should go first, while others firmly believe that according to the Dharma, those furthest from the door but nearest to the altar should go first. In order to save our community, we have agreed to abide by your instructions. Waiting on the truth, signed, Waiting on the Truth. Dear Waiting, people should leave 2 by 2 in order of height, starting with the tallest. Keep a measuring tape by the door in case of uncertainty. Each departing pair should first bow to the altar and then proceed to the doorway to form an arch with their arms. Holding it until the second couple ducks under on their way out. Okay, they're all really good, so it's so hard to choose. Dear Tofu Roshi, is there a gourmet guide to spiritual practice places? My wife and I need to know, in choosing our path, where we can get our dietary needs met. I have heard of Zen centers where peanut butter is the mainstay of every meal, but we're more interested in something in the Nouvelle Cuisine line. Radicchio, chanterelles, that sort of thing. When you give up all your ordinary activities, food becomes even more important than usual, and that's saying something. My wife and I wish to spend our summer vacation on a long retreat. I'm overweight and hope to lose pounds, but gain insights about 20 of each. My wife, who is very slim, is allergic to wheat and milk. I should perhaps add that neither of us is enthusiastic about the idea of eating seaweed, and we wonder if people have been able to get enlightened without it. One more thing, cooked carrots make me gag. What do you recommend for us? Signed, Ori Okie. Dear Ori, do not make false distinctions. Food is Buddha. We are Buddha. When we eat ourselves. Your hair is seaweed. Your legs are carrots. Do you not like your legs? Eat your legs now. You are what you eat, and so is your wife. So it sounds silly, but you know, don't you recognize that person? I don't know if you ever get questions quite like that in books on Taigen, but I sort of hear people making those kinds of demands. There's also a very wonderful glossary in the back. And, you know, the some of the definitions are right on, you know, sutra, a Buddhist scripture. On the other hand, setsu stick. A small spatula-like utensil used for cleaning one's eating bowls after formal Zen meals. A home away from home for bacteria. So I recommend this. For a long time, I just kept it by my bedside, and when I just needed a little something to read to help me fall asleep, I did that. So I won't read from these other two. I just want to say a couple of things about it. Taigen has referred to Dharma Bums numerous times since I've been coming to this temple. And it is... if you haven't read it, you should read it. What can I say? There is a... Just for one example, there's a hilarious depiction of a mountain climbing adventure with a character named Jaffe Ryder, who is a not at all disguised depiction of a young Gary Snyder. And they are... Gary is a very competent mountain man. The rest of them are completely inexperienced, and they have a quite remarkable time climbing a mountain. It's fun and it's funny, and it's even though it's a novel, it's full of sort of hilarious versions of true stories, like the poetry reading in 1955, where Allen Ginsberg, you know, read his poem. How in this book it's called Whale. It's just a wonderful book. This particular copy is the 50th anniversary edition, which just kills me. It's been around for quite a while. And then the last one that I'll mention is called Ambivalent Zen. And Gretel Ehrlich, who's a really good nature writer, says, "I laughed so hard I cried." And again, it's the story of it's a memoir about a very imperfect Zen practitioner. And he covers quite a number of years of him going with various teachers and through various experiences in an extremely relatable and sincere way. So I think they're all great, and I think we should embrace humor as much as we can. At the memorial service for my friend Elizabeth, which was last Saturday, everyone who spoke told funny stories about her. And, you know, we hadn't coordinated, but it was what came out. And I think it was because, you know, we were trying to find the truth about her and say the truth about her in a way that was also healing for us and healing for her family. So, now it's your turn to say your jokes. What you got?
Jessica.
For the past few months, I've been studying improv comedy at Second City, and I find that there's a lot in common between the practice and improv. For instance, when you go into a scene with somebody, you can't go in with any preconceived notions. You have to have that beginner's mind and just let whatever happens, happens. So it's been kind of cool that my Zen practice has informed my improv practice and vice versa. But one thing that you mentioned really ran true for me as far as that goes, and that's that in improv you're looking for truth. Like, you're not trying to be funny. You're trying to say the true thing, and that ends up being funny. So I thought that was a cool bit.
Yeah, it's the only thing that's really funny. That's great that you do improv. You should do a Dharma talk on improv. That would be really fun to hear. It seems like that. The scariest thing in the world. Like the Shuso ceremony.
Yes.
I have one other one that I'll read that I was going to read earlier, and I was running out of time. So if you Google Zen humor, you get a lot of jokes, but you also get a lot of stories. So this is a story from the year 800 that you get if you Google Zen humor. One summer day, the venerable old Chao Chu proposed a little contest of Zen repartee with his attending disciple Wen Wang to see who could identify himself with the lowest thing in the scale of human values. Chao Chu began, "I am a donkey." Wen Wang, "I am the donkey's buttocks." Chao Chu, "I am the donkey's dung." Wen Wang, "I am a worm in the dung." Chao Chu, unable to think of a rejoinder, asks, "What are you doing there?" Wen Wang said, "I'm spending my summer vacation." And Chao Chu conceded. Sorry about mangling those pronunciations.
That's pretty good. Both David was here. David Chadwick is and Sue Moon are both old friends. David was here a few years ago, maybe for more than a week. I don't know how many of you remember him being here. Sue Moon was also here, but I think, but before we moved to this temple, when we were at the cenacle, maybe nobody here remembers her. But she was also the executive director of Buddhist Peace Fellowship, and
so she has a serious side.
Oh yeah, she was. Assistant chair when I was chair of the board at San Francisco Zen Center, so we're old friends. And Tofu Roshi is delightful, and so is the stories in Thank You and Okay. Thank You and Okay is just, you know, one of my favorite books. I think we have all those books. I hope we have all those books in the library. We should make sure we do, Dave. But
Real Norman is what I want to know.
he's a prominent successor of Katagiri Roshi, who leads a temple in the Midwest. He had tremendous trouble. So I actually spent time with David at one of the temples he talks about in that book. When I was living in Japan, and he was still living in Japan, writing the book at the time, and not the temple where he talks about that had the matchbooks. Thank You and Okay, but I also spent time at that temple. It's also one of the best books I know about the difference between Japan and America.
Mm-hmm.
I'm tempted to read an excerpt, but does anybody else have a Zen story or questions about it? Anything? I also did the Takuhatsu you were talking about. I also did when I was at that temple, and it's a wonderful experience. It's not something, a few people have done it in America, but it's not part of our culture. It's very much part of traditional Japanese culture. But does anyone have questions about any of the stories that Laurel read or? Will.
I just want to say thank you for your talk, Laurel.
Oh, you're welcome.
In Zen and in other areas of my life, I think I struggle to not take things too seriously, and humor is a really nice counterbalance.
I think there's just enough time to read. This is just one of the most mystical and really profound little excerpts about the nature of culture and humanity. And if I can find it, I don't think it's too long. If with your permission. If I can find it.
What's the title of this book?
It's called Thank You and OK, subtitle, An American Zen Failure in Japan. And David Chadwick is specialized, I could just tell stories about David. He specializes in outrageousness and has done so for a long time. He was once asked by, I think it was Suzuki Roshi, he was at Tassajara and he was the work leader. And David is loud and colorful. And he was asked by Suzuki Roshi to not speak for a practice period, even though he was the work leader. And that was the loudest silence people could hear. Here it is. I think I found it. This is when he was in Japan, and he calls it Maruyama, but it's Okayama. There's an old temple that he was living at the gates of, and very, very highly respected Rinzai master who now teaches in America. And this is just an account of his going to take a driver's test in Japan. And he's very brave, because I never wanted to drive in Japan. They drive on the English side of the road there. But my first trip to the Maruyama driver's license test building had been spent mainly helping the clerk to do an analysis of my passport, enumerating the countries I'd visited, the dates I had gone in and out of the U.S. and other countries. The stopover in Hawaii for an hour on the way to Taiwan 3 years previously was properly noted. The space of time between the Taiwan trip and my arrival date in Japan was marked down. My month in Thailand and the side trip to Malaysia, as well as the times of visa extensions in Japan, were not neglected. It was a curious procedure. This was local government, not immigration. And I did not get the point, but mine not to reason why. I was told by the precise and bespectacled clerk that I had the honor of being eligible to apply for a Japanese driver's license, although I would have to come back on another day to do so. I made an appointment and thanked him for his assistance. He expressed gratitude for my cooperation and handed me a form in Japanese that he said I would should fill out before my return. A week later, I came, went back to the driver's license test building, arriving between 8:30 and 9 a.m. as I had been instructed. It took about an hour and a half on two buses to get to the building, which was way out of town toward the inland sea. I brought everything I was supposed to bring, including copies of my California license and every page of my passport. It was only a quarter till nine, and the building was already filled with young people, housewives, a few middle-aged men, and some older people who must have come to get their driver's licenses renewed. Hundreds of people. There were endless lines and folks mulling about. No wonder I was told to come so early, I thought. It's going to take me all day merely to get to the window, but I didn't know which window to go to, so I went to the information counter. There was no line in front of it, which meant to me that I was the only person in the room who didn't know what to do. But I liked the answer that I got there when I asked where to go. I was sent to another deserted window where I was met by no fewer than four nervous driver's license test building employees. I felt very special. I was. One employee wearing a neat blue uniform and thick glasses sat in front of me as the other employees looked on. I'm going to go a little over time just because this is so mystical. He smiled and said good morning in English, and I smiled and said good morning in English, and then in Japanese to all four of them. The observers all bowed, smiling, and believed that I could say Ohayo gozaimasu. And they nodded and laughed among themselves in approval. So far, so good. I presented my bundle of documents to the man in front of me, and he looked through them carefully and seemed pleased. We reviewed the itinerary of past travels without a hitch. The others left us alone, having done their part in assuring me by their presence that I was being well taken care of. The man who was left with the task of helping me straightened his glasses and went straight to the form that I was supposed to have filled out. I hadn't. I had tried to fill it out with Savvy Ishitaki, but since nothing applied to me, she decided it was a mistake. It wasn't. At least it was no mistake that it was going to be filled out. Still, I had a lot of trouble understanding it. I had my dictionary out and we were going at it, but we were having problems right away, as much because I couldn't believe what he was asking as because of not understanding the words. He spoke a little English, and between that and my Japanese, we managed to get through it, but not without a good deal of imagination stretching. What actually happened is still unclear, but it had to be done. Just doing things that have to be done is a particular talent of the Japanese. Since this gent was going to so much trouble for me, I was game too and went to trouble for him. As I recall, it went something like this. Him: when was your last written driver's license test? Me: when was my last? I said and stopped to think. He was waiting with his pen on the page. He needed to fill in an answer, and I should not fail him. Vaguely remembering taking such a test in Marin County, California, at some time or times in the present geological age, I said, let's see, 5 years ago, the first Tuesday in May. My tone was definitive and authoritative. We were off to a good start. Him: mm-hmm, 5 years ago, May 1984, very good. He continued in a nasal tone of voice that rose in pitch at the end of each question. And was it a multiple choice or a true-false test? Actually, he was speaking a mixture of English and Japanese, and throughout this account, I am sparing the reader questions like Tetsuru wa ABC choisa make did, or other right true. Me, switching back, I looked for an old driving test memory, and sure enough, there it was. I could see the paper and the questions with the blank line on the left. How many feet can you safely behind it? Yes, it must be. Multiple choice, I said, wondering why anyone cared. Him: yes, multiple choice, okay. His follow-up threw me. And what was your score? He kept looking at the paper. Me: okay, what the heck? 92, I answered. Him, writing carefully and drawing his voice out. 92, he continued his quest for precise details. And how many questions were there? Me, unhesitatingly and enunciating clearly, 20. Wouldn't everybody say that? It might be right too, but then the score couldn't but have been 92, I realized later. Him believed in writing it down. And what make of car were you driving then? Me, without trying to calculate for sure, I've gone through a lot of cars, but most of them have been Toyota. I'm getting into the swing of it. Him: very good. And then spelling it out as he wrote with increased confidence that this was something we could in fact do. T-O-Y-O-T-A. Now catch this, his next question. What was the rank of the officer who administered this test? Me: I'm reeling in delight. I hadn't hoped for anything so wonderful to happen on this day. He was an inspector. We are on a roll. We are one. He puckered his lips ever so slightly and neatly entered the word inspector on the form in katakana. The way he wrote it, it would be pronounced insopekata. Him: what office administered the test? At this point, he listed some completely inapplicable Japanese government agencies. Me: the DMV, I said truthfully. Him: DMB, he repeated as they do in Japan, using their 50 sounds. Actually, it would be DMOB. Me: it stands for the Department of Motor Vehicles, I explained. He liked it, I could tell. And what section of government is the DMV under? Me: the California State Police, I said, and then thought back to my days of working for state government in California. Now, it's probably directly under General Services, but ah, who cares? He liked the state police idea anyway. Now, get this, him: And what language was the test administered in? Japanese or English? We were brought together, soaring in a unique, surrealistic world. Time stopped as I cherished the moment. When I heard the question echoing for the third time in my blissful state, I leaned down and with a slight pause to show that I was considering the matter carefully, answered precisely, English. Him, English, and he circled it. And did you take a driving test? Me, not at that time. I was trying to be honest. I probably should have just said yes. Him, when did you take a driving test? Me, in 1978, total sad. Him, 1978. And was that your first driving test? Me, no. Him, when did you take your first driving test? Me, gee, it had been a long time. My very first one? I had one back in 65, I think, but I was 13 and a half when I got my beginner's license. Take me a second. 1958. Him, a little thrown off, looking back, looking up. 1958? Me, yes, back then in Texas, farm kids had to drive. It's very wide. I stretched my arm out. The word why did it. It's one of the main words they use in Japan to describe the U.S. It accounts for many differences, and I just explained why I had a license at an age that must have seemed unthinkable to him. I wouldn't doubt that at that moment he formed the permanent thought that all people in the States, at least in Texas, start driving at 13, a fact that he might have connected with our high crime rate, but that was now also likely to be associated with the concept why. Him, having been thrown off a little, returning to the flow, and was this examination given on a test course or in the streets? Me, both, replied me again. Him, what make of car did you take the test in? Me, never flinching but with no clear idea, Chevrolet. Him, would you spell that please? Me, C, A, B, C, H, hello, E, E, T, V, V, S, O, P. I was proud of my clear choices up to that point. It went confidently into the next letter, R, Rambo. A Japanese word incidentally pronounced about the same means violence or rudeness. He quickly wrote the R and went on to, oh, okay. Now the big one, L, lucky. And just to make sure I gave it the Japanese pronunciation, error, R is aru. He wrote it down, seemingly appreciative of the hint. E, Elvis, he liked that. T, Truman, he was old enough to know who that was. He looked up, there was a pause. I knew we were near the end, his lips parted. Him, how many cc's was the engine of the car? Me, I spoke back from timelessness and without thought. I had come to Japan to study the teaching beyond words and letters, and here I had surely found it. How many cc's does a big car have? I had heard emanating from my throat. Him, 2,000 cc's. Me, 2,000 cc's. After that, everything went white. Anyway, it goes on. But sorry, I've gone on longer than time permits.
There's a lot of chapters like that.
On that note, thank you all. And thank you, Laurel, for bringing some fun. So we'll close with the four Bodhisattva vows, which are in the next to the last page of your chapter.
Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them, but as way is unsurpassable, I vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable.